Most people think feeling lost means something has gone wrong. They assume emptiness is a personal failure, a sign that they're unmotivated, broken, lazy, or ungrateful. But existentialism begins with a radically different insight. Meaninglessness is not a defect. It is a signal. It appears when the old answers no longer fit the life you're actually living. It shows up when the beliefs, goals, and expectations you inherited stop working, not because you failed, but because you outgrew them. The crisis is not the problem. The crisis is the beginning of honesty. For most of human history, meaning was largely given. You were born into a role, a religion, a tradition, a clear path. You didn't have to ask who you were or why you were here. The answers were waiting for you before you arrived. Today, that world is mostly gone. We live in a time of unprecedented freedom, choice, and comfort. And yet beneath the surface, many people feel strangely hollow. They wake up, go through the motions, achieve things they were told would matter, and still feel like something essential is missing. This is not because life is too hard. It's often because life is too scripted. One of the deepest sources of emptiness is living according to scripts you didn't consciously choose. From an early age, most of us are handed a blueprint. Go to school, get a job, find a partner, stay busy, stay productive, stay comfortable. None of these things are wrong on their own. The problem begins when you follow them automatically, without ever asking whether they actually reflect your values. When you live a life designed by default, you may look functional on the outside while feeling disconnected on the inside. Existential emptiness often appears when your life is full, but not yours. Another source of emptiness is living reactively instead of deliberately. A reactive life is one where your days are shaped by notifications, obligations, expectations, and external pressures. You respond, adapt, adjust, but you rarely choose. You wake up already behind, already chasing, already reacting to demands you didn't set. Over time, this creates a subtle sense of powerlessness, not because you lack freedom, but because you never stop long enough to exercise it. Existentialism begins where reactivity ends. At the moment you pause and ask, is this how I want to live, or is this simply what happened to me? Many people also mistake comfort for fulfillment. Comfort promises safety, ease, and the absence of discomfort. Fulfillment, on the other hand, often requires effort, uncertainty, and responsibility. Modern life is incredibly good at reducing friction. Food delivered to your door, entertainment on demand, endless distractions. But a life optimized only for comfort often feels strangely empty. Why? Because comfort removes friction, and friction is where meaning is forged. Growth, responsibility, and commitment all involve tension. When life becomes too smooth, too easy, too insulated, it can start to feel flat and unreal. This is where the existential crisis truly begins. Not as a breakdown, but as a question. A quiet, unsettling question that surfaces when distractions fade. If nothing is guaranteed, how should I live? If there is no fixed destiny, no predetermined purpose, no cosmic script, then what do my choices mean? What should I give my time, energy, and attention to? This question is uncomfortable because it removes excuses. It doesn't allow you to hide behind tradition, authority, or certainty, but it is also the most honest question a human being can ask. Many people try to escape this question as quickly as possible. They rush to fix their lives. They look for productivity systems, motivation hacks, or quick answers that promise clarity overnight. But existentialism warns against this false urgency. Clarity does not come from rushing forward. It comes from standing still long enough to see clearly. When you immediately try to fill the emptiness, you miss the message it's trying to deliver. The discomfort is not there to be eliminated, it's there to be understood. This is why the first practical step is simple, but not easy. Name your emptiness. Instead of distracting yourself or labeling it as weakness, sit down and write honestly. Ask yourself, where do I feel most empty right now? Is it in your work, your relationships, your sense of direction, your daily routine? Don't analyze, don't judge, just describe. One full page, Most people have never done this. They live with a vague sense of dissatisfaction without ever giving it language. But what remains unnamed quietly controls you. The moment you put words to your emptiness, you turn confusion into clarity. The second action is to remove false urgency. Modern culture constantly pressures you to act, optimize, improve, and move faster. But existential clarity does not obey deadlines. You do not need to have your life figured out by a certain age. You do not need immediate answers. Rushing to fix your life often leads to shallow solutions. New goals, new routines, new identities, built on the same unexamined foundation. Instead, give yourself permission to slow down. Tell yourself, clarity comes before direction. It is better to pause and reflect than to sprint in the wrong direction for years. The third action is to accept uncertainty consciously. This is one of the hardest steps because the human mind craves certainty. We want guarantees that our efforts will pay off, that our choices are correct, that we won't regret our decisions. Existentialism offers none of that. Instead, it invites you to make peace with not knowing. A simple daily practice can help. Remind yourself, I don't need answers yet. I'll never have answers, just not yet. This small shift reduces anxiety and creates space for honest exploration. Uncertainty is not a threat. It's the condition of freedom. At this stage, nothing dramatic is required of you. No radical life changes, no grand declarations. The work of this section is internal. It's about stopping the escape from discomfort, from questions, from yourself. Meaning does not appear when you silence the question. Meaning begins when you stop running from it. When you allow yourself to sit in the discomfort without numbing it, rushing past it, or trying to solve it prematurely, something subtle but powerful happens. You reclaim ownership of your life. The existential crisis, then, is not a dark pit you fall into. It's a threshold you arrive at. On one side is a life lived by default, reactive, comfortable, externally guided. On the other side is a life lived deliberately, chosen, imperfect, and fully owned. The existential crisis deepens when we understand why the old answers stopped working in the first place. This is where Friedrich Nietzsche enters the story. Nietzsche did not invent meaninglessness, nor did he celebrate despair. What he did was diagnose a historical shift that most people feel today without having words for it. He looked at modern humanity and realized something unsettling. The structures that once gave life meaning were collapsing, but we were still living as if they hadn't. For centuries, meaning came from outside the individual. Religion told you who you were, why you existed, and how you should live. Tradition handed you a role, often before you could question it. Identity was fixed. Your place in the world was largely decided by birth, culture, and duty. These systems were not perfect, but they had one undeniable strength. They removed the burden of choice. You didn't have to invent meaning. You inherited it. Nietzsche saw that this world was ending. When he famously wrote that God is dead, he wasn't making a shallow attack on religion, nor was he celebrating chaos. He was describing a psychological and cultural reality. The old sources of absolute meaning no longer held the same power. Science replaced faith. Individual choice replaced tradition. Skepticism replaced certainty. The problem was not that people stopped believing. It was that they stopped believing together. Shared meaning dissolved, and nothing equally strong took its place. This collapse created a strange new condition. On the surface, people became freer than ever before. You could choose your career, your beliefs, your lifestyle, even your identity. But beneath that freedom, something darker emerged: uncertainty. When meaning is no longer given, it must be created, and creation requires responsibility. Nietzsche understood that most people were not prepared for this. They wanted freedom, but they still craved certainty. They wanted choice, but not responsibility. This tension is at the heart of modern existential anxiety. When freedom replaces certainty, many people panic, not always loudly, often quietly. The panic shows up as numbness, cynicism, distraction, or endless irony. Instead of asking, "What should I stand for?" people retreat into detachment. They joke about everything. They refuse to take anything seriously. They keep their options open, their commitments shallow, and their beliefs flexible enough to avoid risk. This is not freedom. It is fear disguised as intelligence. One of the great dangers Nietzsche warned about is nihilism, the belief that nothing truly matters. Nihilism often appears sophisticated. It wears the mask of realism. It says, if there is no absolute meaning, then everything is pointless. But Nietzsche saw this as a halfway response, a refusal to take the next step. Nihilism is what happens when old meanings die, but new values are never born. Another danger is living ironically. Irony allows you to distance yourself from life. You participate, but without commitment. You say, nothing really matters, but continue living as if it does, just without responsibility. Irony protects you from disappointment, but it also prevents fulfillment. You cannot build a meaningful life while standing at a distance from it. Meaning requires skin in the game. It requires risk. It requires the possibility of failure. Perhaps the most subtle danger is never committing deeply to anything. In a world of endless options, commitment feels like loss. Choosing one path means closing others. Choosing one value means rejecting alternatives. Many people delay commitment indefinitely, waiting for certainty that never arrives. But Nietzsche understood something crucial. Certainty does not come before commitment, it comes after. A value only becomes meaningful when it is lived, tested, and carried through difficulty. Nietzsche's insight was not that life is meaningless, but that meaning must now be created by individuals strong enough to choose. He believed humanity stood at a crossroads. One path led to nihilism, resentment, and weakness, a life spent reacting, criticizing, and avoiding responsibility. The other path led to self-creation, the courage to say, this is what I stand for, even without guarantees. This is where existentialism becomes practical rather than abstract. If meaning is no longer received, then the question is not what is the meaning of life, but what values am I willing to live by? Values are not slogans or preferences. They are principles you are willing to pay a price for. They shape how you act when no one is watching, when motivation fades, and when comfort is threatened. The first practical step is to audit your inherited values. Most people live by beliefs they absorbed unconsciously, from parents, culture, school, social media, or fear. Sit down and ask yourself honestly, which beliefs did I adopt without choosing? What do you believe about success, relationships, happiness, strength, failure? Where did these beliefs come from? Are they truly yours, or were they simply handed to you? A belief you didn't choose cannot give your life meaning. It can only give it structure. The second step is to choose one value consciously, not 10, not a vague list. One value you respect deeply enough to live by even when it's inconvenient. This could be truth, strength, honesty, growth, responsibility, discipline, compassion. The specific value matters less than the seriousness of the choice. Nietzsche believed most suffering comes not from hardship, but from living without a clear internal compass. A single chosen value can anchor your life more than 100 borrowed opinions. The third step is to live that value for 30 days, regardless of motivation. This is crucial. Values are not proven in moments of inspiration. They are proven in ordinary, resistant days. If you choose honesty, practice it when it's uncomfortable. If you choose growth, show up when progress feels slow. If you choose strength, act when weakness would be easier. Do not ask whether it feels right. Meaning does not begin with feelings. It begins with action. Over time, something subtle happens. The value stops being an idea and becomes part of your identity. You don't need external validation. You don't need certainty. You experience something far more stable, self-respect. Nietzsche understood that meaning is not something you think your way into. It's something you become through repeated choices. This is why he valued strength. Not physical dominance, but the strength to choose, to commit, and to endure uncertainty without collapsing. Meaning begins the moment values are chosen, not received. The world will not hand you purpose. History no longer assigns it, but this is not a curse. It is an invitation. The death of given meaning is painful, yes, but it is also the condition that makes authentic meaning possible at all. Only a free individual can create a life that truly belongs to them. To truly understand existentialism, we have to face one of its most unsettling ideas, the absurd. This concept was articulated most clearly by Albert Camus, not as an abstract theory, but as a lived experience. The absurd is not depression, it is not pessimism, it is the moment you realize that there is a deep mismatch between what you want from life and what life is willing to give you. You crave meaning, order, justification, and purpose. And the universe responds with silence. No explanation, no reassurance, no final answer. This realization doesn't usually arrive all at once. It often sneaks up on people during ordinary moments. You achieve something you worked toward for years, and instead of fulfillment, you feel a strange emptiness. You follow the rules, make the right choices, and still feel unsettled. Or you experience loss, suffering, or injustice and realize there is no higher reason that makes it fair. The absurd appears when the question why echoes into a void that never answers back. Camus believed this confrontation is unavoidable for an honest person. Once you see the silence, you cannot unsee it. The universe does not explain itself. It does not reward virtue consistently. It does not punish wrongdoing reliably. It does not care about your hopes, your fears, or your plans. This is not cruelty, it is indifference. And this indifference is what makes the absurd so difficult to accept. We are meaning-making creatures living in a world that does not provide meaning. Faced with this realization, Camus argued that humans tend to respond in one of two instinctive ways, both of which he firmly rejected. The first is suicide, either literal or symbolic. Literal suicide is the physical act of ending one's life. Symbolic suicide is giving up on life inwardly, drifting, numbing yourself, refusing to engage deeply, or living on autopilot. Camus rejected this response because it avoids the problem rather than confronting it. Ending life does not solve the absurd, it simply eliminates the one being capable of experiencing it. The second response Camus rejected is illusion. Illusion takes many forms. Religion can be an illusion when it is used not as faith, but as a desperate escape from uncertainty. Ideologies can be illusions when they promise total explanations for a chaotic world. Even personal myths. Everything happens for a reason. It will all make sense someday. The universe has a plan for me. Can become illusions if they are used to silence doubt rather than face it. Camus called this philosophical suicide. Killing the question by inventing an answer that cannot be verified. Camus refused both escape routes. Instead, he proposed a third response, revolt. Revolt does not mean violence or rebellion against society. It means an inner stance. It means living fully while refusing false comfort. It means acknowledging the absurd without trying to solve it. Revolt is the decision to stay awake in a world that offers no final explanation. Revolt means saying, yes, the universe is silent, and I will live anyway. It means refusing to let the lack of cosmic meaning drain life of intensity. Camus believed that the absurd, once accepted, actually sharpens life. When nothing is guaranteed, every action becomes more vivid, Every moment becomes more precious, not because it is eternal, but because it is fleeting. Meaning is no longer something you wait for at the end of the road. It becomes something you express through how you walk the road itself. This is why Camus famously wrote about Sisyphus, the man condemned to push a boulder up a mountain only for it to roll back down forever. From the outside, Sisyphus's life looks meaningless, but Camus imagined something radical. Sisyphus, aware of his condition, a man who knows there is no final victory, no reward, no escape, and still chooses to push. In that awareness, Camus saw freedom. In that refusal to surrender, he saw meaning, not as an answer, but as a stance. This is where the absurd becomes practical. The first action Camus invites us to take is simple, but deeply challenging. Stop asking, what's the point? And start asking, what will I commit to anyway? The question, what's the point, assumes meaning must be guaranteed before action is justified. Camus turns this logic upside down. He asks, what if action itself is the source of meaning? What if commitment comes first and justification never arrives? The second practical action is to create daily defiance. This does not require grand gestures. It means choosing one small, difficult, meaningful act each day, despite doubt, fatigue, or uncertainty. Write even when you feel uninspired. Train even when progress feels slow. Speak honestly even when silence would be easier. Show up even when you don't know where it leads. These acts are not heroic in the traditional sense. They are quiet forms of rebellion against a world that offers no guarantees. Daily defiance matters because the absurd does not disappear after one decision. It returns constantly, in moments of failure, boredom, repetition, and suffering. Camus did not promise transcendence, he promised resistance. Revolt is not a one-time choice, it is a posture you adopt again and again. Each day you wake up and choose to participate fully, knowing there is no final meaning waiting to reward you, you reaffirm your freedom. The third practical action is to detach from outcomes. This is crucial. Many people try to create meaning, but secretly hope the universe will validate them in return. They want effort to guarantee success, suffering to guarantee reward, commitment to guarantee fulfillment. Camus asks you to let go of this expectation. Focus on effort, not cosmic validation. Measure your life not by results, but by the integrity of your engagement. Did you show up? Did you act honestly? Did you live fully, even in uncertainty? Detaching from outcomes does not mean apathy. It means refusing to let your sense of worth depend on forces outside your control. When you stop demanding that life justify itself to you, you gain something rare, inner stability. You are no longer waiting for permission to live. You no longer need certainty to act. You move because movement itself becomes meaningful. Camus believed that once you accept the absurd, life becomes strangely lighter, not easier, but clearer. You stop postponing life until conditions improve. You stop waiting for meaning to arrive from the outside. You stop bargaining with the universe. Instead, you live with intensity, presence, and honesty. You laugh louder. You love more fiercely. You commit more deeply. Not because it will last forever, but because it matters now. Meaning, in Camus' view, is not an answer you discover at the end of thought. It is a stance you take in the face of silence. It is the courage to say yes to life without guarantees, to push the boulder without hope of final victory, to live fully without illusions and without despair. The absurd does not ask you to give up on life. It asks you to stop asking life for permission. And in that refusal, that quiet, persistent revolt, meaning is no longer something you seek. It becomes something you embody. If Nietzsche showed us that inherited meaning has collapsed, and Camus taught us how to live without cosmic guarantees, Jean-Paul Sartre takes us one step further, to a truth that is even more uncomfortable. Sartre argued that once there is no given meaning, no fixed essence, no destiny written in advance, something unavoidable follows. You are radically free, not partially free, not free in theory, completely free, and therefore completely responsible. This is why Sartre used a phrase that sounds almost cruel. You are condemned to be free. Not because freedom is evil, but because you cannot escape it. What Sartre meant is simple, though difficult to accept. You are not born with a predefined nature that determines who you must become. You are not secretly guided by fate. You are not waiting for your true self to be discovered. You exist first, and only afterward do you define yourself through what you do. Your actions are not expressions of who you already are. They are what make you who you are. There is no essence behind the scenes, quietly directing your life. There is only choice, followed by consequences. This idea unsettles people because it removes comforting illusions. If there is no built-in essence, then there is no one to blame for the shape your life takes. Not your parents, not society, not your personality, not your past. These things influence you, yes, but they do not decide for you. Sartre's claim is not that circumstances don't matter. It's that they never remove choice. Even in constraint, you choose how to respond. Even in limitation, you choose what stance to take. Even in suffering, you choose how much responsibility you will claim. Faced with this level of freedom, most people instinctively try to escape it. Sartre called this escape bad faith. Bad faith is not lying to others, it is lying to yourself. It is pretending that you are not choosing when, in fact, you are. It shows up in ordinary language, disguised as humility or realism. I had no choice. That's just how I am. I'm not built for that. Life forced my hand. These phrases feel innocent, but Sartre saw them as acts of self-betrayal. They reduce a free being into an object, something acted upon rather than someone who acts. Bad faith feels comforting because it removes guilt and responsibility. If that's just how I am, then no change is required. If I had no choice, then no courage was demanded. But the cost of bad faith is immense. Each excuse quietly erodes your sense of agency. Over time, you begin to experience your own life as something that happens to you rather than something you shape. This is how people become strangers to themselves, not through tragedy, but through a thousand small acts of denial. Sartre insisted that even refusing to choose is still a choice. Indecision is not neutrality. It is a decision to delay, to avoid, to let circumstances decide for you. Waiting for clarity is a choice. Staying in a situation you resent is a choice. Remaining silent when you could speak is a choice. Freedom does not disappear when you close your eyes to it. It simply becomes unconscious, and therefore more destructive. This is why Sartre believed freedom is terrifying, not because it demands heroism, but because it demands honesty. It demands that you recognize yourself as the author of your life, even when the story is messy, unfinished, or painful. There is no script to follow, but there is also no one else holding the pen. The weight of this realization often produces anxiety. Not because something is wrong, but because something important is now visible. Sartre's insight cuts through one of the most common modern illusions, the belief that we are trapped by our identities. People say, I'm an anxious person, I'm bad with discipline, I'm not confident, as if these traits were permanent structures. Sartre would say, these are descriptions of past behavior, not definitions of your being. The moment you act differently, the description changes. Identity is not a prison, it is a pattern. And patterns can be broken through action. This brings us to the practical core of Sartre's philosophy. The first action is deceptively simple. Replace excuses with ownership. Listen closely to how you speak to yourself. When you say, I can't, pause and translate it honestly, I choose not to. This shift is uncomfortable, but it is liberating. I choose not to restores agency. It reminds you that avoidance is still a decision, and that decisions can be revised. You may still choose not to act, but now it is a conscious choice, not a hidden one. The second action is to choose one area of life where you stop blaming circumstances. Just one, not everything at once. It could be your health, your work, your relationships, your creative life, or your daily habits. Identify the story you usually tell yourself about why change is impossible. Then set that story aside, not because it's completely false, but because it is incomplete. Circumstances explain difficulty. They do not erase responsibility. Sartre does not ask you to deny reality. He asks you to stop hiding behind it. Once that area is chosen, the third action follows naturally. Act immediately, imperfectly. Sartre believed that reflection without action becomes another form of bad faith. You do not become free by thinking about freedom. You become free by exercising it. Action clarifies what thought cannot. You do not need confidence to act. Confidence is often the result of action. You do not need certainty. Certainty is something people invent after the fact. What you need is movement. This action does not need to be dramatic. In fact, it shouldn't be. Send the message you've been postponing. Take the first small step toward a goal you've been overthinking. Set a boundary you've been avoiding. Speak one honest sentence you've been rehearsing in silence. These acts matter not because they guarantee success, but because they affirm your authorship. Each action says quietly but firmly, I am not an object. I am a choosing being. Over time, something powerful happens. Responsibility stops feeling like a burden and starts feeling like strength. When you accept responsibility, you stop waiting for rescue. You stop hoping circumstances will change first. You stop bargaining with the future. You begin to experience yourself as capable, not because life becomes easy, but because you are no longer divided against yourself. Freedom grows not when options increase, but when responsibility is accepted without resentment. Sartre's philosophy does not promise happiness. It promises dignity. The dignity of standing behind your choices. The dignity of refusing to lie to yourself. The dignity of acting even when the outcome is uncertain. A free life, in this sense, is not a comfortable life. It is a coherent one, where your actions align with your awareness, and your awareness does not hide from itself. Radical freedom is not something you achieve once and keep forever. It must be reaffirmed daily. Each morning you wake up free again, and tempted again to deny it. Each day offers new excuses, new pressures, new reasons to drift. Sartre's challenge is not to eliminate these pressures, but to meet them honestly, to see your choices clearly, to own them fully, and to act anyway. Freedom then is not the absence of limits. It is the refusal to pretend you are not choosing. And the moment you stop pretending, the moment you accept responsibility without flinching, your life begins to feel different. Not lighter, but real. Because for the first time, it is truly yours. Anxiety is often treated as something broken, something pathological, something that needs to be eliminated as quickly as possible. We talk about it as a weakness, a malfunction of the mind, a sign that something is wrong with us. But existentialism offers a very different interpretation. Existential anxiety is not a flaw, it is a signal. It appears at the precise moment you realize a truth most people spend their lives avoiding. My life is in my hands. No one else can live it for you. No one else can choose for you. No one else can carry the consequences of your decisions. That realization is heavy, and anxiety is the emotional weight of that freedom pressing down on you. This kind of anxiety doesn't come from danger. Fear comes from something specific, a threat, a risk, a clear source of harm. Existential anxiety is different. It is vague. It has no clear object. You feel restless, unsettled, tense, even when nothing bad is happening. That's because anxiety is not warning you about what might happen. It's confronting you with what could happen. Possibility itself becomes overwhelming when you realize you could change your life, leave what no longer fits, commit to something meaningful, or fail publicly. The sheer openness of the future can feel unbearable. This is why anxiety often appears right before important decisions, not small choices but life-shaping ones, changing direction, committing to something deeply, taking responsibility, stepping into uncertainty. The mind senses that once you act, there is no one left to blame, and so it resists. Not because the action is wrong, but because the freedom is real. Most people do not consciously recognize this. Instead of seeing anxiety as a signal of freedom, they interpret it as a problem to be silenced, and so they numb it. Modern life offers endless tools for numbing anxiety, and most of them are socially acceptable. Distraction is the most common. Endless scrolling, constant background noise, podcasts playing even in silence, notifications filling every empty moment. When anxiety tries to speak, distraction drowns it out. Another common response is overworking. Staying busy feels productive, but it often serves the same purpose as distraction. When every hour is filled, there is no space to feel, no time to ask uncomfortable questions, no room for stillness. Overworking allows you to say, "I don't have time to think," which often really means, "I'm afraid of what I'll realize if I stop." Then there is consumption, not just of food or products, but of experiences, information, and stimulation. Buying things, chasing upgrades, watching more, learning more, optimizing endlessly. Consumption creates the illusion of movement without commitment. It feels like progress, but it rarely demands responsibility. It fills the void temporarily, while leaving the underlying anxiety untouched. The tragedy is that the more we numb anxiety, the stronger it becomes in the long run. Avoidance does not resolve anxiety. It teaches your mind that anxiety is dangerous. And when the mind believes anxiety must be avoided at all costs, it becomes hyper-alert to its presence. This creates a loop. Anxiety appears, you escape. Anxiety returns stronger, you escape faster. Over time, your world shrinks. You stop taking risks. You stop choosing. You stop engaging deeply with life. Existentialism breaks this loop by reframing anxiety entirely. Anxiety is not telling you that something is wrong with you. It is telling you that something important is at stake. It appears when your life is not being lived passively, but stands open before you. In this sense, anxiety is the emotional proof that you are free. If your life were fully determined, anxiety would have no place. You would simply follow the script. This is why some of the most anxious people are also the most capable of meaningful lives. They feel anxiety because they sense possibility. The danger is not anxiety itself. The danger is letting it dictate your choices. Anxiety becomes destructive only when it paralyzes you. And paralysis comes not from anxiety, but from refusal to act. This brings us to the first practical action. Sit with anxiety for 5 minutes daily without distraction. This sounds simple, but it is deeply uncomfortable. No phone, no music, no background noise, just you and the feeling. Let it be present without labeling it as bad. Notice where it lives in your body. Notice how it rises and falls. You are not trying to solve it. You are training yourself to realize something crucial. Anxiety cannot harm you. It can be felt without being obeyed. This practice slowly breaks the association between anxiety and danger. The second action is to identify the choice you're avoiding. Anxiety is rarely random. It usually clusters around something specific, even if it feels vague at first. Ask yourself honestly, what decision am I postponing? What action am I avoiding? What truth am I delaying? Often, anxiety intensifies precisely where responsibility begins. Naming the avoided choice turns anxiety from an enemy into information. It tells you where your life is asking for movement. The third action is to take the smallest possible step toward that choice. Not a dramatic leap, not a complete transformation, just the smallest action that breaks paralysis. Make the call, write the first paragraph, schedule the appointment, take a 10-minute walk toward clarity. Action does not eliminate anxiety instantly, but it changes its quality. Anxiety that follows action is very different from anxiety that precedes it. It becomes quieter, more focused, more manageable. This is because anxiety shrinks when action begins. Not because the future suddenly becomes certain, but because you are no longer frozen. Movement restores agency. It reminds your nervous system that you are not trapped. Even imperfect action signals to the mind, I am capable of responding. And that signal is calming in a way no distraction ever will be. Over time, you begin to notice a shift. Anxiety no longer dominates your inner world. You learn to carry anxiety instead of running from it. You begin to trust yourself more, not because anxiety vanishes, but because you know you can act despite it. Existentialism does not promise a life without anxiety. It promises something better, a life where anxiety no longer decides for you, a life where discomfort becomes part of growth, not a reason to retreat, a life where you recognize anxiety as the cost of having a say in your own existence. Anxiety in this sense is not the enemy of meaning. It is the doorway to it, because the moment you stop trying to silence anxiety and start listening to what it's pointing toward, you take another step out of passivity and into authorship. And that is where meaning quietly begins to take shape. After everything we've explored, the collapse of inherited meaning, the silence of the universe, radical freedom, and the anxiety that comes with it, a natural question remains. So how is meaning actually created? Not in theory, not in books, not in motivational quotes, but in real life on ordinary days with imperfect people. Existentialism gives a surprisingly clear answer. Meaning does not arrive as a revelation. It is not discovered by thinking harder. It does not descend when you finally find your purpose. Meaning is built, slowly, quietly, through engagement with life. Existential meaning comes from four simple elements: choice, commitment, responsibility, and action. These are not abstract ideas, they are behaviors. They describe what a person does, not what a person thinks. This is where many people get stuck. They assume meaning is something you must understand before you act. Existentialism turns this assumption upside down. It says, act first, meaning follows. The first element is choice. Meaning begins the moment you choose something deliberately instead of drifting into it. A choice is powerful not because it guarantees the right outcome, but because it ends passivity. Even a flawed choice is better than none, because it places you inside your own life instead of on the sidelines. Many people feel lost because they are waiting for certainty before choosing. But certainty is not a prerequisite for choice. It is often a byproduct of commitment. Life clarifies itself through movement, not contemplation. The second element is commitment. Choice without commitment is shallow. It remains theoretical. Commitment means deciding not just what you prefer, but what you will stick with when things become difficult, boring, or unrewarding. This is where meaning deepens. A life filled with endless options but no commitments feels empty because nothing is allowed to matter enough. Commitment creates gravity. It turns actions into identity. You are not what you intend, you are what you repeatedly commit to. The third element is responsibility. Responsibility is often misunderstood as burden, but existentialism sees it as ownership. When you take responsibility for something, a role, a task, a relationship, a craft, you stop waiting for someone else to fix, validate, or rescue you. Responsibility ties your actions to consequences. It grounds you in reality. And paradoxically, this grounding is what gives life weight and meaning. A life without responsibility feels light, but also hollow. A life with responsibility feels heavy, but real. The fourth element is action. This is where meaning actually takes shape. Not dramatic action, not heroic gestures, ordinary repeated action. Showing up, doing the work, acting even when motivation fades. Existentialism is deeply suspicious of endless thinking because thinking can become a substitute for living. You can analyze your life forever without ever inhabiting it. Action, even imperfect action, forces you into contact with reality, and reality is where meaning lives. This is why existentialism rejects three common traps. The first is thinking endlessly. Reflection is valuable, but only up to a point. When thinking becomes circular, it stops being insight and becomes avoidance. You replay possibilities, imagine outcomes, rehearse identities, but never test them. Meaning cannot survive in your head alone. It needs friction. It needs resistance. It needs the real world. The second trap is waiting for passion. Many people believe they must feel inspired before they commit. They say, "Once I find my passion, everything will make sense." But passion is not the starting point. It is often the result of sustained effort. Passion grows where attention is invested. It develops through competence, familiarity, and care. Waiting for passion keeps you stationary. Acting without passion often creates it. The third trap is searching for purpose as if it were a hidden object waiting to be uncovered. This search can become endless. You read, watch, plan, and compare, always hoping the next insight will finally tell you what your life is meant to be. Existentialism cuts through this illusion. There is no pre-written purpose assigned to you. There is only the purpose you build through what you are willing to carry and sustain over time. Meaning, then, appears after engagement. It is not the cause of action, but its consequence. This is difficult to accept because it requires faith without guarantees. You must act without knowing whether it will pay off. You must commit without certainty that it will feel meaningful tomorrow. But this uncertainty is not a flaw. It is the condition under which authentic meaning becomes possible. This leads directly to the practical actions of this section. The first is to choose one responsibility worth carrying, not 10, one, something that demands effort and consistency. It could be a craft, a project, a person, a habit, or a role you know matters, even if it doesn't excite you every day. The key question is not, does this make me happy right now? But is this weight worth carrying over time? Meaning is closely tied to the burdens we willingly accept. The second action is to commit publicly or structurally. Private intentions are fragile. They disappear when motivation fades. Commitment needs structure. This could be a schedule that doesn't depend on mood, a habit anchored to a time and place, or accountability that makes your choice visible. Public commitment doesn't mean seeking applause. It means removing easy escape routes. When commitment is externalized, it stops being a feeling and becomes a practice. The third action is to show up daily, even when it feels meaningless. This is where most people fail, and where meaning is actually forged. Early effort often feels empty. You act without feedback. You invest without immediate reward. This is normal. Meaning grows slowly, beneath the surface, like roots. If you quit too early, you never reach the stage where effort turns into identity and identity turns into fulfillment. Showing up when it feels pointless is not a sign you're doing something wrong. It's often a sign you're doing something real. Over time, something shifts. The responsibility you chose begins to shape you. The commitment you honored gives structure to your days. The actions you repeat form habits, and habits form character. Meaning appears quietly, not as excitement, but as coherence. You feel aligned. You feel grounded. You feel like your life is about something, even if you can't easily explain it. This is why existentialism insists that purpose is built, not found. Found purposes are fragile. They depend on inspiration, clarity, and perfect conditions. Built purposes survive doubt, boredom, and difficulty. They grow stronger the longer you carry them. They do not promise happiness, but they offer something deeper: direction, self-respect, and inner stability. A meaningful life in this sense is not a life without confusion or struggle. It is a life where struggle is integrated into something you have chosen to stand behind, where effort is not random, but directed, where days are not just endured, but invested. Meaning does not appear when life becomes easy. It appears when you decide what is worth your effort, and then give yourself to it. And once meaning is built this way, it cannot be taken from you by circumstance, silence, or uncertainty, because it was never given to you in the first place. It was created by choice, commitment, responsibility, and action. At this point in the journey, one final obstacle remains, and it may be the most difficult one to overcome. Even after accepting uncertainty, choosing values, embracing freedom, acting despite anxiety, and building meaning through responsibility, many people still live with a quiet leash around their neck. That leash is approval, not obvious approval, but the subtle, constant awareness of how one is seen, judged, measured, and compared. Existentialism does not fully come alive until this leash is loosened. When Sartre wrote the line, "Hell is other people," he was not saying that relationships are evil or that solitude is superior to connection. He was pointing to something far more precise and far more dangerous. Living through the eyes of others destroys authenticity. The moment you begin to experience yourself primarily as an object being observed, evaluated, and judged, you stop being fully present in your own life. You begin to perform instead of live. You act not from inner conviction, but from imagined reactions. This kind of living creates a divided self. On one side is who you are when no one is watching, your instincts, thoughts, doubts, and values. On the other side is who you present to the world, filtered, edited, adjusted for acceptance. The longer this division persists, the more hollow life feels. You may be admired, liked, or praised, yet feel strangely absent from your own existence. Approval feels good in the moment, but over time it replaces authenticity with strategy. Modern life has amplified this problem beyond anything Sartre could have imagined. Today's other people are no longer just the individuals physically present around you. They are abstract audiences, metrics, numbers, likes, views, followers, comments, comparison feeds. These systems constantly ask the same question: how are you being received? And the more often you ask that question, the harder it becomes to ask the more important one: is this honest? This is the modern hell, not suffering imposed from the outside, but self-surveillance from within. You begin to anticipate judgment before it happens. You shape your words, choices, and even desires around how they might be perceived. Over time, this leads to a quiet form of self-abandonment. You no longer act to express who you are, you act to manage how you are seen. Comparison deepens this trap. When you constantly measure yourself against others, your sense of worth becomes relative and unstable. Someone will always appear ahead of you, happier than you, more successful than you, more admired than you. Comparison does not motivate authenticity, it erodes it. It shifts your attention outward, away from your own path, and ties your sense of meaning to standards you did not choose. Existentialism challenges this at its core. If meaning is created through choice, commitment, and responsibility, then living for approval undermines meaning itself. Approval is external. It fluctuates, it cannot be controlled. Building a life around it is like building on water. You may feel momentarily supported, but you will never feel grounded. Living authentically does not mean rejecting all feedback or isolating yourself from others. It means something far simpler and far braver. You stop letting approval decide for you. You allow yourself to be seen as you are, rather than constantly adjusting to be accepted. You accept that disapproval is not a failure. It is often the cost of being honest in a world that prefers conformity. This brings us to the practical actions of this final section. The first is to stop optimizing for approval in one area of life. Just one. It could be how you express yourself online, how you dress, how you speak in meetings, how you pursue your interests, or how you structure your time. Notice where you habitually ask, "Will this be liked? Will this be approved? Will this be accepted?" Then for that one area, consciously choose a different metric. Is this aligned with what I actually value? This step often feels uncomfortable because approval has become a reflex. You may feel exposed, awkward, uncertain, but this discomfort is a sign of realignment. It means your actions are beginning to come from the inside rather than being negotiated externally. Authenticity rarely feels smooth at first. It feels raw. But rawness is a sign of presence. The second action is to do one honest act daily that risks disapproval. This does not mean being provocative or reckless. It means being sincere where you would normally self-censor. Speak one true sentence you would usually soften. Share an idea without over-editing it for acceptance. Say no when you would usually say yes to avoid discomfort. These acts are small, but they are powerful. Each one reclaims a piece of your agency. Over time, you may notice something surprising. Disapproval is rarely as catastrophic as you imagined. Some people may disagree, some may not understand, some may drift away, but what remains grows stronger. Self-respect. And self-respect is far more stable than approval. Approval depends on others. Self-respect depends on alignment between your values and your actions. The third action is to measure success internally. This is essential. As long as you measure your life by external response, you remain vulnerable to forces you cannot control. Existentialism proposes a different standard. Effort, integrity, and consistency. Did you show up? Did you act honestly? Did you honor your commitments, even when no one noticed? These are measures no algorithm can take from you. Internal measures change the emotional tone of life. You stop riding constant highs and lows based on feedback. You become steadier, more grounded. You no longer need to win every comparison because you are no longer playing the same game. You are playing a quieter one, a deeper one, where the reward is coherence rather than applause. Living authentically also transforms relationships. When you stop performing, your connections become more real. Some relationships will fade, not because you failed, but because they were built on performance rather than truth. Others will deepen. You will be seen more clearly, and you will see others more clearly in return. Authenticity does not isolate you. It filters your world until what remains is solid. This is the final existential shift. Not from confusion to certainty, but from dependence to ownership. From living as an object in others' eyes to living as a subject in your own life. From asking, am I approved, to asking, am I aligned? At this stage, meaning no longer feels like a puzzle to be solved. It feels like something you are carrying, something you uphold through how you live, not what you achieve. The world may still be silent. There may still be no guarantees, but your life is no longer waiting for permission. And this brings us to the final message, the quiet truth that holds everything together. The world may be meaningless, but your choices are not. Meaning is not given. It is not promised. It is not discovered waiting somewhere in the future. Meaning is carried. Carried through responsibility, carried through commitment, carried through action, carried through honesty. And once you accept that, once you stop asking the world to justify your existence, something changes. You stop drifting, you stop hiding, you stop postponing life. You stand inside it, not with certainty, not with guarantees, but with courage.